Thank you very much. At school, in the afternoon classes, we call it the graveyard shift. It's the time when students, especially in certain subjects, have a tendency to nod off. And I know if I was in the audience, I'd be in the same way, especially after lunch. We'll try to make this act of learning as much as possible. And as we turn now to the figure of priesthood, we have to confess, don't we, that we've already touched on some of these principles. We keep saying that there are overlapping principles, and yet there are some distinctive principles about each figure. Very briefly, we've explored the figure of the family in the house, or the family in the home, taken a look at it briefly from the Old Testament, some key passages, some of which we don't usually quote and refer to very much, and then we've traveled into the New Testament with that. We went down here to the image of the tabernacle and the temple. And if we hadn't thought about it before, again, although there are overlapping principles, when you really get down to it, looking at Old and New Testament, there are some distinctions between the idea of a tabernacle and its principles as opposed to the concept of a temple and its principles. In fact, we can see that the one figure advances us a little further in the realization of our role, God willing, in the future as we become part of something permanent. We're not going to be today dealing so much with the concept of the flock. Well, that's one of the classes we have actually as part of the series. But we are going to take a look at the concept of priesthood. The concept of priesthood is important. The passage in Peter is only one passage that we could have looked at that clearly teach there's a sense in which we are now training to be a family, a house. True enough, in Peter's words, we are stones as part of the building. True enough, in Peter's words. But we are also training to be a priesthood. There are lessons now that we need to learn about priesthood. We'd like to travel back for a few moments into the Old Testament once again. Just look at the concept of priesthood as it was laid out in the Old Testament, and then travel forward again into the New. So as we have done before, I'm going to share with you a little outline in terms of a prospectus for the class. First of all, looking at the priesthood in the Old Testament, we'd like to turn to the call of Levi, where so much is packed into the reason why God chose the Levites as a family. I can remember asking myself this question not so long ago, and I don't mean when I was young, only within the last year or so, trying to answer this question myself. So why did God choose Levi above all the tribes to be the priesthood? And you know, when we explored this for the first time at Bible school, a number of brothers and sisters said, you know, I guess I read that in the readings, but it never really came clear to me. Why Levi? Why not Judah? Why not Issachar? Why not Zebulun? So we'll look at that. And in doing it, it's not just an academic exercise. The reason why God chose Levi actually helps to define the role of priesthood. Then we're going to take a look very briefly at this important concept that's entailed in the role of being a priest in the Old Testament, the role of Christ in his preparation to be a priest, and of course, for ourselves, we know from the book of Revelation, chapter 6, that we hope to be kings and priests. Revelation 6, standard passage. We hope to be kings and priests. So, that's brothers and sisters. That's a role not only for men, but also for sisters. And the sympathetic aspect of our priesthood is something we learn now in the days of our flesh, which the Master was to learn in preparation for him to be our great high priest now. A little bit of work again on service and inheritance. In terms of Levi, there are some unique features about those two things with the priesthood. A little bit of work here on the issue of women also. I know you're going to say, oh, women weren't priests, though. No, they're not priests in the Old Testament. But there's a sense in which our sisters must see themselves as being prepared for a priesthood role, God willing, in the future. Every role will be different, but there are some principles that apply to our sisters as well as to the brethren in the future. So we're going to then finally finish off, God willing, with some work in the New Testament. Some terms for priestly service that carry through, subtly carry through, from Old Testament into New. I'm going to come back to the call of Levi. It's going to be sort of a full circle in the end, but we're not going to the Old Testament roots. We're going to talk about the call of Levi in the New Testament, and then an expression which the Apostle Paul uses in reference to having his brethren upon his heart, which, if we haven't seen before, is an important priestly concept, to have his brethren on his heart. Now, just a quick survey by using some graphic clues. There was the priesthood, there was the high priest, and now I'm speaking especially to those of you that are just new in the truth, and the young people in particular. This can be very confusing when you talk about the priesthood. Of course, you had a special family, the family of Aaron. When Aaron died, Eleazar, his son, took over. The priesthood traveled through the sons of Aaron. Now, here's something to bear in mind. All of those priests, like Aaron, came from the tribe of Levi. Not all Levites became priests. But if you're a priest, you had to come from Levi. So let me say that again. If you're a Levite, it didn't mean you were necessarily going to be a priest unless you were connected to the sons of Aaron. So not all Levites became priests. But if you're a priest, you had to come from the tribe of Levi. And the Levites is a term used in the Law of Moses, which can be confusing to early readers. Levites were a group of servants to the priests. They were priestly because they were part of the priestly tribe. But not all Levites actually became, quote, the high priest or the priests directly. So the Levites were in the priestly service. They were regarded in a small letter P as priests, or they were priestly. But they weren't ever able to be a high priest unless they came from a specific family. Now, as you take a look at the service, this picture is illustrating the service of the high priest, who on the Day of Atonement took the censer, the coals being removed from the altar, the coals being put into the bottom of the censer, and the incense fumigating as it was sprinkled on top of the coals of the incense altar, of the incense container, which he would use to go in on the Day of Atonement once a year. He used that as a cloud, a veil, a screen, as he went into the Holiest of Holies. On that special occasion, he wore certain clothes. On other occasions, he wore his official garments. His official garments, if it was on a day that was not when he went into the Holiest of Holies, would have had the 12 stones of the breastplate. That would have been part of what was called the ephod. We read about the ephod earlier, that it was made of one work. Okay? It was made of one work. He had a bonnet. He had a mitre, which said holiness to Yahweh. He had children, did Aaron. He had children that assumed that role by a family line. But as a high priest, there were others who assisted him in that role. The sons of Aaron, his other family members, and the Levites in general. All of which, as we've said this morning when we talked about how his clothes were described, they were described as clothes of service. Clothes of service. Another role was to attend to some of the daily functions of the tabernacle or later on the temple. One of those daily functions, or in the morning and in the evening, was to offer incense. Another function was to offer the burnt offering. Other functions included getting the animals ready. And there's where the Levites would come in. The general family of Levi would have assistants or servants as Levites that would assist the preparation for a lot of these functions. They would help to prepare, for example, some of the perfumes. They would prepare the animals for offering. They were responsible for the butchering of the animals once they had been offered. All of which, when the Israelites looked at these people, they saw constantly the principle of service. Turn to Exodus 19 with me, would you now? Exodus 19. We have said that this included sisters as well. And we qualify that, not in the sense that sisters were the high priest. No. Not in the sense that sisters could offer animal sacrifices. No. But in Exodus chapter 19, the whole of the nation, men and women, sisters and brothers, boys and girls, were to see themselves being called to the principles of priesthood, whether you're a man or a woman. The principles were principles related to service, and it applied to everybody. So as we look at this overhead, which we would think of, oh yes, that was a male job, and it was a male job. It was the job of the attending Levites, depending on the task, if it was just turning the animal over, preparing the sacrifices. It was something that was very unique. If it was part of the eating of that sacrifice, that would have been for Aaron and his sons. But in Exodus chapter 19, God says to the whole of the nation, and this is before the priesthood is formally set up, as we think of the priesthood. Verse 5 of Exodus 19. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel. That is not just referring, in fact, to the males. When God says in the apocalypse that we shall be kings and priests and we shall reign on the earth in Revelation 6, there is a priestly role, however it will be worked out, in the future for sisters. Now, I don't have any doubt that their role will be different than the brethren. But there is a sense in which, clearly, the passage in Exodus, the passage in the apocalypse that we shall be kings and priests is all-encompassing. And the Peter passage that we've turned to about four times today, that we are to be a holy generation, we're to be a house made of living stones, we are to be a royal priesthood, quotes Exodus 19 in the New Testament. Peter is not just writing to brethren in his epistle of Peter, 1 Peter 2. So now, sisters, there's a sense in which these concepts, these priestly concepts, as well as for the brethren, have a relevance. Now they have a relevance, and they have a relevance as we all prepare for our different roles in the future age, God willing. That's very important to think about as we review how did the priests function. Fundamentally, this concept of offering sacrifice, unique to the priesthood as a job, is in fact something clearly, in a general way, applicable to sisters. Did you see it? 1 Peter 2. This passage, 1 Peter 2, that we started with, we just go back there from Exodus. Did you see the concept of offering sacrifice was not just something that was God was teaching just the males of Israel, that they were to offer sacrifice, or they were to live sacrificially, if we advance it to personal application. Look at what he says, 1 Peter 2, verse 5. Ye also, as living stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. The ye is not just the brethren reading the epistle. Ye also, as living stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood. Here it is, to offer up spiritual sacrifices. When you think of this picture and what it portrays of the priesthood tasks in the Old Testament, don't just think that that was teaching that males were to be connected alone with the concept of sacrifice. It was teaching disciples to be disciples that live sacrificial lives. And so Peter, when he quotes this very passage in Exodus 19 that we read about being a kingdom of priests, and says we are to be a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a chosen generation, says that we are to offer up not literal sacrifices, but spiritual sacrifices. In other words, the whole parable of watching the priests offer animal sacrifices was a parable that taught, in part, both men and women that they were to live sacrificial lives. And that they were spiritually, as the New Testament says, to offer up spiritual sacrifices. How? by the praise of our lips and by our daily way of life. Paul says in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, it's our reasonable service that we should offer our bodies as a living sacrifice. Romans 12, verse 1. That's not just something males do. Not just male disciples. We are to offer our bodies as a living sacrifice. It's the language of the law. It's the language of lessons from the priesthood. And that applies to sisters as much as it does to brothers. So as we talk about this concept of priesthood, I want us to think that this is not something just like a male exhortation. One of the tasks was to look after the lampstand. Now we think of young Samuel. Young Samuel as a priest in training with Eli at a time of corruption was associated with a time when the lamp was about to go out. The oil supply was down. The attendance at the tabernacle was shabby. But the lessons in the days of Samuel are important. You remember that Eli's sons were actually committing promiscuous acts with the women that attended at the door of the tabernacle. Do you realize those women at the door of the tabernacle takes you right back to the law of Moses, where there were women at the tabernacle that served on a regular basis? Only in the days of Samuel, it was being obviously corrupted by immoral practice. But those women actually were part of a Levitical service, because obviously Levi had children that were women as well as men. The women had certain roles to play. And they were there in the days of Samuel, only it was being corrupted in its application. Male and female, however, in the New Testament, are associated with that symbol, because in the Apocalypse, as the Apocalypse opens, the seven ecclesias are pictured as seven lampstands. And that didn't just involve the men. It involved the women as well. There's a sense in which, therefore, as young people, men and women, we're all called to this service. Although our roles are different, and we have different responsibilities, and there's a special headship that is attached to the role of the male. Definitely. But all of those roles still are very much related to priestly principles. And as you look at the symbols of service, as we're just going through them, just little snapshots that remind us of what the priests did. As you think about how they're interpreted in Scripture, it's not just a male application. Very important to remember that. Let's just take a look at something else that reminds us from the law of Moses concerning the sin offering. Now we're getting technical here, a little more technical anyways, with the sin offering. When a sin offering was offered, there was a delineation, a breaking down of different offerings depending on who had committed the sin. I want to start at the bottom. If a commoner committed a sin, and this is all in the book of Leviticus, first six chapters. If a commoner committed a sin, he was to offer, or she, a goat kid, or a female lamb. If it was a ruler, it was a goat kid that was a male. If the whole congregation had committed a sin, they were to offer a bullock. If the priest himself committed a sin, he was to offer a bullock. That's a cow, the most expensive of all the offerings, the biggest animals that were domestic at the time. But do you see the point? One man, the priest, had to offer, when he sinned, as much as the whole nation, if they sinned. It was a national apostasy, or some national falling away, like at the golden calf, where the whole nation committed a sin. What is it telling us? The priest offers the same as the nation, because the priest represents the nation. The priest represents the nation. The whole nation was to see in that priest, men and women, in that priest, priestly principles. Remember Exodus 19? They were called to be a nation. They were called to be kings and priests as a whole nation. Exodus 19. Everybody was to look at the priest and his special role and learn principles that were applicable to everyone. Now, let's focus next. Having done that as a general introduction, let's now take a look specifically at why Levi. What was there about Levi, for one reason or another, that made God give them special privileges? So I want you to turn now, please, to Deuteronomy chapter 10. If you would, please. Deuteronomy chapter 10. Why Levi? And as we answer that question, hopefully, we can discern some reasons as to why that helps us understand what priesthood is all about for disciples. Deuteronomy chapter 10, and then we're going to look at Deuteronomy chapter 17. We're going to start very simple. Why Levi? And then we'll work to the more detailed passage. Deuteronomy 10, verse 8 reads, "At that time Yahweh separated the tribe of Levi to bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord." And what's he say? To stand before Yahweh, to stand before the Lord, to minister unto him, and to bless in his name unto this day. Point number one. Levi was chosen and separated by God. And they were separated to stand before the Lord. By the way, that's a priestly phrase. When you see stand before the Lord, elsewhere in the Bible, almost always it's a priestly concept, to stand before the Lord. It has its roots in a priestly service. It has its roots in a priestly service. So Levite was to stand before the Lord. What was it to entail? To minister unto him. Fundamentally, Levi was chosen because God separated Levi. God did it. Why Levi? God did it. You remember the blueprints for the tabernacle? Why do we have to measure it this long? Why does the ark have to be that long? Why do you have to have boards that size? You will do it according to the pattern. We read that in our last class. God prescribed the blueprints of the tabernacle. God separated the tribe of Levi. The simplest answer to start with is, why Levi? Because God separated Levi. Secondly, he separated Levi as priests to stand before the Lord for the purpose of service, for the purpose of ministering. If the nation was going to learn anything about priesthood, it was to learn, first and foremost, priesthood had to do with service. Let's look at the second passage. Look at the second passage, chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17, verse 12. It's going to get a little more challenging or more detailed as we just move through these fundamental passages. Why Levi? "And the man that will do presumptuously," that's any man, "and will not hearken unto the priest that standeth to minister there before the Lord thy God, or unto the judge, even that man shall die, and thou shalt put away the evil from Israel." Well, what about that passage? To stand before the priest is to stand before God. He was a representative. It's a representative principle. Do you see what that's got to do with us? If we're called to be a kingdom of priests, if we are to be kings and priests in the future, we are being prepared for a role that is godlike. We're being prepared to be his representatives on the earth in the future. There's a sense in which we are his representatives now. Paul says we are ambassadors for Christ. Same concept. Now, we're not very good at it, and we're imperfect ambassadors. We're imperfect representatives. But think of the challenge. Eventually, like the priests of old, we are to help Christ in the kingdom age and the Father. And as such, we will be given the authority vested in us as it was in the priests of old. To stand before the immortal saints will be like standing before the angels. It'll be like standing before the ordained priests of the Old Testament when God was inspiring them and guiding them. To stand before the priest was to stand before Yahweh. He will guide us in the future when we're inspired and immortalized, God willing. But when that takes place, we will be his representatives, helping on the earth. That's an awesome vision, an awesome vision. It means that now we are training to be his representatives. When people see us as young people, when they see us as older brothers and sisters, they should see something about their God in us. We are his representatives in a smaller sense than the priest, but we are just exactly that in training. That's awesome. Let's turn to another passage. Now we get a little more challenging. Deuteronomy chapter 33, please. Deuteronomy chapter 33. Okay, I got the Bible passage there written. Deuteronomy 33, I want to look at verses 8 to 10. I have a second overhead which finishes it off. Let's look at verse 8. Why Levi? And of Levi he said, let thy Thummim and thy Urim. That's an expression that has to do with the ephod that we saw with the breastplate and the 12 stones in the earlier picture. Okay, the Urim and the Thummim have to do with the ephod, that garment that has the 12 stones. Of Levi he said, let thy Thummim and thy Urim be with thy Holy One, whom thou didst prove at Massah, and with whom thou didst strive at the waters of Meribah. Two places where the people of Levi, it would seem, proved their faithfulness. There doesn't seem to be a direct reference to that in terms of the role of Levi at those two incidents, although we know more about them from another passage. But somehow their faithfulness was displayed. We come to verse 9. Who said unto his father, this is Levi, who said unto his father and to his mother, I have not seen him. Neither did he acknowledge his brethren, nor knew his own children, for they have observed thy word and kept thy covenant. Now I realize that's not going to be too obvious as to what that means. So if I can just put something here to hold the position of this so it doesn't go off as an overhead. There we go. Let's look at this together. Levi actually was willing to say to his father and to his mother, I don't know you. I know that sounds challenging, but just hang on to it. Neither did he acknowledge his brethren, nor knew his own children. That language is referring, in fact, to the incident at the golden calf, where Moses said at the golden calf, when everybody, pretty well everybody, was engaged in this orgy, Moses said, who's on the Lord's side? And Levi was the first to come over to Moses' side. And in doing that, Levi was willing to leave his other brethren. He had other brethren. He had other family in the other tribes. He was willing, when he came over to Moses' side as a whole tribe, to not let family ties to mother, father, children, if necessary, hold him back to come over and stand beside Moses. He was willing to, in other words, sacrifice his own family ties, if necessary, in order to serve Yahweh and stand on the right side of things. It wasn't a matter of being snobby and holding his nose and not being interested in his brothers or sisters or being disrespectful to his mom and dad. Levi is described as being entitled to this special blessing of service because of his loyalty as a tribe. There was a loyalty. It was exhibited, according to verse 8, at Massah and Meribah. It was exhibited, though particularly, in the incident of verse 9. Now, we go down to verse 10. Here's the privilege. They, that's Levi, shall teach Jacob thy judgments, and Israel thy law. So, Levi is chosen because of his faithfulness. And Levi is now privileged with the role of being teachers. So part of the role of being a priest, part of the role of being part of Levi, was to be a teacher. They shall offer before thee an whole burnt sacrifice upon thine altar. Bless Yahweh, his substance, that's the substance of Levi, and accept the work of his hands, smite through the loins of them that rise against him. They were to respect the Levites as the representatives of God. But because they were willing to be loyal to Yahweh when there were decisions to be made for the whole nation. They were blessed with the right decision, having made the right decision. They were blessed with the privilege of service. And they were especially to be teachers of the law. Very important. Levi was to offer sacrifice. That's true. Levi was to offer incense and do all the various things that we've talked about with respect to the lampstand and so on. But they were also to be teachers of the law. Turn to Numbers 18, if you would. Numbers 18. Just cutting into verse 2. This is in the context of bringing the children of Levi, the tribe of thy father, bring thou with thee, that they may be joined unto thee and minister unto thee. But thou and thy sons, that's the sons of Aaron, with thee shall minister before the tabernacle of witness. Now here's the role of Levi in general. Here's the role of Aaron and his sons, the priests. Aaron and his sons minister before the tabernacle. The Levites are to be joined in service to the priests. They're all Levites, but the sons of Aaron are the priests, the priestly family. And the Levites are to be joined unto Aaron and his sons to minister to them. So you got Aaron and the sons, the high priest and his family, and they're Levites. But the rest of the Levites in general are appointed to be servants to the sons of Aaron, to help their service. So you got a group of people helping others serve. And they are to be joined unto the sons of Aaron. Come down to verse 4. Look at the language in verse 5. And they shall be joined unto thee. Verse 5. And ye shall keep the charge of the sanctuary, the sons of Aaron. Now look at verse 6. Verse 6. And behold, I have taken your brethren, the Levites, from among the children of Israel. To you they are given as a gift. This is God speaking to Aaron and his sons. The Levites, your brethren, are given to you as a gift. Do you ever think of that? As applying the priestly concepts, do we ever think of the fact that our brethren and sisters are given to us as Levites or as priests in training? They're given to us as gifts. The other brothers in this room, the other sisters, the other young people in this room are given to us to help us serve. And we're given to help serve them. In the law of Moses, the principle of service was stressed to the Levites. And they were to serve the sons of Aaron. And they were given as gifts to the sons of Aaron. That was an expression of grace and goodness. It wasn't that God left the sons of Aaron to do it all themselves, but they looked upon their brethren, were to look upon their brethren, as being gifts to them, all of which was intended to help with service. And you know, you come down to verse 7 of Numbers 18, and you get the same point again. In verse 7, I have given your priest's office unto you as a service of gift, and the stranger that cometh nigh shall be put to death. Embedded here in Numbers 18, then, is an important principle of mutual service. The sons of Aaron are to serve as priests. The Levites in general are to serve. They're to serve the priests. And they're to be looked upon as being gifts for service. I wonder if we were to look at our brothers and sisters that way, thinking about our premise from the beginning of our study, if we were to look at our brothers and sisters that way, I wonder if that would change the way we treat them at times when we're angry and frustrated. To remind ourselves that even though we may be ticked, annoyed, frustrated, or perhaps concerned about the bad example of someone else, nevertheless, they are given to us mutually as a family, as a priesthood. They're given to help us serve, and we are to help them serve. And they're given to us by God as gifts. Our brethren and sisters as gifts. Turn to Malachi, if you would. Malachi chapter 2. Why Levi? what's important about Levi's service. Well, here's another partial answer to the question, why Levi and what's Levi supposed to do as a priestly family? Malachi chapter 2, verse 4 down to verse 7. Verse 4. And ye shall know, says God, that I have sent this commandment unto you, that my covenant might be with Levi. With Levi, saith the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him, that's Levi, of life and peace. And I gave them to him for the fear with which he feared me and was afraid before my name. That's a compliment to Levi back at the times of Meribah and the other location mentioned in that passage where they show their faithfulness. And the golden calf, where they came on the Lord's side with Moses. My covenant, says God, with Levi was of life and peace. I gave them to him for the fear wherewith he feared me and was afraid before my name. If you check your Bible margin at that point in Malachi, you should see a reference to the book of Numbers, which takes you to the incident of Phinehas. In fact, the language of life and peace and the covenant is drawn directly from the book of Numbers in reference to Phinehas, who picked up a javelin when his people went a-whoring after those who were worshiping Baal Peor. And Phinehas took the javelin when he saw a couple engaging in an immoral act, and he thrust the javelin through in their tent. And by doing that, Phinehas stopped the plague that was breaking out in the book of Numbers against his people that went a-whoring after the people of the Moabites and were connected with the worship of Baal Peor. That language, a covenant of life and peace, is picked up in Malachi, and it's woven into the reasons in Malachi why he chose Levi. Another reason, the behavior of Phinehas in the book of Numbers, towards the end of the wilderness wanderings. When Phinehas, who by the way was a priest, in the priestly family of the sons of Aaron, who took his javelin and put an end to immorality in the tents of Israel. And God says in the book of Numbers, it's connected with the covenant of peace and life. So, reasons for Levi. There's another one. Verse 6, the law of truth was in his mouth, and iniquity was not found in his lips. That's a compliment to Levi at the beginning. That's one of the reasons he chose Levi, and they were blessed with the privilege. The law of truth was in his mouth. Now, you remember that passage in Deuteronomy said he was to teach Israel God's judgments? Well, this is what this is talking about. The law of truth was in his mouth, a teacher. And iniquity was not found in his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity and did turn many from iniquity. Part of the flashback to the time of the golden calf, part of the flashback to Phinehas, who put an end to immorality. Phinehas does something with his javelin that's very similar to what happens when Moses stands and says, who's on the Lord's side? And he puts an end to the orgy taking place at the golden calf. Verse 7, for the priest's lips should keep knowledge, and they should seek the law at his mouth, for he is the messenger of Yahweh of hosts. You see that? That's going back to the passage in Deuteronomy that says the role of Levi with their privileges was to teach Israel God's judgments. They were to be teachers. They were to know God's word. Now you just think about this in terms of ourselves. Young people, brothers and sisters, getting ready to become a priesthood in the future age, wishing to be part of the kingdom of priests, a royal priesthood. If we're priests now in training, then we are to apply these principles. The law of truth should be in our mouth. We should love God's word, and as we said to the young people last evening, we need that in our heart if we're going to push out the influence of the world. Now, there's no doubt with respect to the world that we've got to have jobs in the world. And we've got to have some degree of training or education in order to make our way, quotes, in the world. Paul was a tent maker. He had two friends in the Acts that were tent makers. They had skills. They had jobs. Abraham was blessed with material goods, but he didn't get that by simply sitting on a bench. He was a herdsman, and a successful one at that. But he was blessed by the fact that obviously he had to do certain things to make his daily bread. We have, obviously, a responsibility to acquire the skills, the trade, the education, the profession, whatever word you want to use, in order to provide resources for our family, provide resources for ourselves to live by, and the resources we need to help the community and the ecclesia, and those who are without, that have nothing. So it's not a matter of saying our role is to forget about any education or any training. No, that's not the message. But in relation to the world, we're not tied by the world. It doesn't become the end. It doesn't become, as it were, the basis of our close friendships. But, the most important education is the education of the Word. The most important education is to know and have knowledge about God's Word if we're going to be priests now in training. And that's for sisters as much as it is for brethren. We are priests in training. The priest's lips should keep God's law and should be willing to be teachers of God's instruction. So now, speaking of priesthood, those two passages, by way of partial review here. What we did, we brought Exodus 19 together with 1 Peter, didn't we? And we show that in the Old Testament, the Exodus 19 passage was a calling to the whole nation. And Peter, simply by inspiration, applies it in the New Testament. It's a universal principle. Ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests. Kingdom of priests. Peter's words, you are a chosen generation, a royal idea of kingdom, a royal priesthood. So, let's go a little further. In looking at this role of priesthood, we come back to our prospectus here for this class. Looking at the role of priesthood, there's something else here that's important that switches it from being something that could be appearing as just academic. And it's the sympathetic principle. One of the things that God did, if you turn now to the book of Hebrews, was to help his people, try to help his people, understand this principle of being sympathetic to each other. And you can see how it relates to our ecclesial life. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4. Says the Apostle Paul at the end of that fourth chapter of Hebrews 4. He says, verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest that has passed into the heavens. And who's that? Well, he takes it very clearly, says it very clearly. Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our profession, seeing we have a great high priest. Verse 15, for we have not a high priest which cannot be touched with the feelings of our infirmities. We don't have a priest that can't be touched by our personal weaknesses and our infirmities. He was in all points tempted like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy in the time of need. You see what he's saying? Jesus had to go through it himself. Jesus had to be human. Not merely human, but he had to be human. He had to be born of a woman, born of a daughter of Adam. Jesus Christ, by being of our nature, was prepared like the priests of old that were human, to be sympathetic, to be touched with other men's weaknesses and infirmities. He had a bond with them because he had the same nature. He had a bond with the sinner, although he was to be a perfect example. Of course, he would have failed too. Then chapter 5. Look at how this flows on. Hebrews chapter 5 continues and builds on this point. Verses 1 and 2 alone. For every high priest, says Paul, taken from among men, is ordained of men in things pertaining to God, that he may offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. Now look at the punchline. Who can have compassion, speaking about the priests in the Old Testament, who can have compassion on the ignorant and on them that are out of the way, for that he himself also is compassed with infirmity. A priest in the Old Testament was a human being, and because he was human, he failed and had weaknesses. And having those weaknesses, he could have compassion on the ignorant and those that were out of the way, means to stray like a sheep. For that he himself also has infirmities. He himself also is weak. That was a principle of the Old Testament priesthood. That's a principle that is applied to the priesthood of Jesus Christ, who has the role now of being the great priest. But in the days of his flesh, he knew what it was to be human and to be tempted. Now that's a comfort to us. When we pray to God now, through Christ and in his name, we know that God hears us, and we know we have a high priest in heaven that is able to be compassionate, understanding with us, with me, and my personal failings at school, at work, at home. How so? Because in the days of his flesh, he was tempted in all points like me. In the days of his flesh, like the priests of old, being human, he too was encompassed with weaknesses, with infirmities. He had our flesh, our nature. And although he never sinned, he knew what it was to have the pulls. So that's a comfort when you pray to God through Christ, that Christ as our priest understands, he sympathizes. But what about us? In the future age, we hope to be a priesthood, and we're a priesthood now in training. God is putting you and I through experiences now that will help us to understand sinners, if we don't already understand it ourselves, in ourselves. By having to deal with other sinners of our nature, with our failings, it teaches us patience, the need for mercy to others, the need for kindness and love to others. In other words, we are being taught now through other people's weaknesses that we are weak. And it helps us to understand what Christ is now able to do for us sympathetically. That's a wonderful thing, isn't it? As you consider the role of priesthood in the ecclesia, and what it says to us by way of exhortation. Now, we mentioned that women also are involved in this service. Well, how were they? Well, we've mentioned in the days of Samuel, there were the women at the tabernacle. That goes back to a time in the Old Testament when women came to the tabernacle and donated some of the necessary materials for the tabernacle. Some of them helped to sew and to spin and to use their skills for the tabernacle. There were the daughters of Levi, of course, that lived around the area of the tabernacle and served in different ways. But you know also, if you ever wanted to be a Nazarite, if you wanted to be a Nazarite, you could be a woman as well as a man. And if you became a Nazarite, you actually took on a kind of priestly role unofficially. If you took a Nazarite vow, you had to let your hair grow, something I'd have troubles with. You'd have to let your hair grow, and you'd have to abstain from alcoholic beverages and even from the fruit of the vine. You were dedicating yourself, if you took a Nazarite vow, to special service. And a man could do it, and so could a woman. And the crown of the Nazarite is described in the same Hebrew word, with the same Hebrew word, as the crown of the high priest. And that is to do with the head covering. That's to do with the hair that was the Nazarite's crown, same Hebrew word, nezer, as is used for the crown of the high priest. In many respects, the Nazarite simulated the role of a priest, and it was open to women as well as men. Now you know who some of the famous ones were. Of course, Samson was a Nazarite, just to name one. But other women could be in the same role as well and take on that special vow. Now, there's something here about inheritance. Would you just come, please, to Deuteronomy 18. This is rather intriguing, and it's the kind of thing you can sort of skate over when you're doing the readings and miss a very valuable point. Deuteronomy chapter 18. Verses 1 and 2. And just think about how this applies to us and folds back to one of our earlier figures of discipleship. Verses 1 and 2 of Deuteronomy 18. The priests, the Levites, and all the tribe of Levi shall have no part nor inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the offerings of Yahweh made by fire and his inheritance. Therefore shall they have no inheritance among their brethren, that's the Levites. Yahweh is their inheritance, as he hath said unto them. A Levite owned no land. Other tribes owned land. Judah, Benjamin, Simeon, Issachar, Zebulun, Manasseh, Reuben. And if you were members of those tribes, you could own property. Acres for your sheep, farm. Yes, you could own land. But a Levite owned no land. His whole task was involved in serving Yahweh. Around the temple, later on in the days of Solomon and the kings, or earlier in the tabernacle. A priest did not own property. The inheritance he had, or she had, as a member of Levi, was simply vested in Yahweh himself. And it depended on the people of Israel, with their tithes, to give you necessary food, belonging, and the raw materials that you needed to live by. It was based entirely on the donations and free will offerings of others by which you would be assisted to live. And you lived around the tabernacle. In the temple, you lived in the temple precincts. But your inheritance was Yahweh. Now, isn't that an eternal principle for New Testament disciples? It doesn't matter how much property we own. It doesn't matter how big our house is or how small. All of that's going to pass away one day when we die, before the Lord's return, or when he comes, if he comes before we decease. And you know what? The apartment, the rugs, the room, all the things that we so much cherish will just be unimportant. What will be important is to whether or not we are Yahweh's. In the ultimate sense, disciples of all ages find their inheritance really in God alone. And the material is very passing and very limited. So there, in Deuteronomy 18, is another discipleship passage. And it should affect the way we live. Now, as we take a look here, coming around now towards the last post, and looking at just our last concluding thoughts, in the New Testament, there are some terms that are used to describe priestly service. Just want to look at this for a minute. Priestly service. In order to look at the passage in John's Gospel, since we're in the Old Testament, would you just look at Numbers chapter 8? I want you to see the idiom, the peculiar Hebrew expression. If you've never noticed this before, it's really quite neat to see how this idiom, this peculiar expression, form of expression, is used in the New Testament. Numbers chapter 8, verses 24 and 25. This is it that belongeth unto the Levites. From 25 years old and upward, that shall go in to wait upon the Lord. That shall go in, rather, to wait upon the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. Better said. In verse 25, and from the age of 50 years, they shall cease waiting upon the service thereof, and shall serve no more. Now look at your Bible margin, if you have one. Verse 24, to wait upon the service. In verse 24, the margin of the AV, to war the warfare. And the second one, they shall not cease waiting, they shall return from the warfare of the service. Number two, that second expression, the warfare of service in the AV margin. Service was regarded as a warfare for the priests. So although they were priests, their work for Israel, their service, their ministry is pictured in military terms. They shall not cease the warfare of service. Isn't that amazing? They were not soldiers, but they were spiritual soldiers if they were priests and Levites. Their service was a service of warfare, even though they didn't pick up a sword. Now we have another figure that merges with priesthood, the imagery of the soldier. And then there's this idiom, this expression, to war the warfare. To war the warfare. Come over now to John 9. John chapter 9. Now, this appears as an expression in quite a number of places in the New Testament, and it comes out not always as warfare, but it comes out with the same idiom. It's a priestly kind of idiom. Numbers chapter 9. Verses 3 and 4. Numbers 9, verses 3 and 4. And Jesus answered, neither hath this man sinned, nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him. I must work the works. There it is. It's the same kind of idiom as war the warfare. I must work the works of him that sent me. While it is day, the night cometh, while no man can work. To work the works. Now that expression, that kind of expression, appears a number of times in different forms in the New Testament. It's very much related to the idea of war the warfare. Work the work. It's all to do with different types of service. And in this context, it's picking it up as a very common Hebrew expression from the Old Testament tied to the idea of priesthood. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 10. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 10. If you haven't noticed this before, same kind of expression. Work the works, war the warfare. Verse 10, 1 Corinthians 16. Now if Timotheus come, see that he may be with you without fear, for he worketh the work of the Lord. It's a work of service. Indeed, it's a warfare as well, but he will work the work. It's rather a peculiar expression in English, but it's a Hebrew idiom, to work the work. John says, to work the work. And in Hebrew, the Hebrew of the margin of the Old Testament, they are to war the warfare. So, it's rather interesting to notice that in the New Testament, priestly terms and phrases are picked up to describe discipleship. Now would you turn, as we bring our thoughts to a close with Levi, full circle in the New Testament, would you come to the Gospel of Luke, please? Luke chapter 5. Luke chapter 5. Luke 5. What does Levi and the call of Levi have to do with New Testament exhortation? You're going to find this, I think, as I found it anyways, quite intriguing that it appears here in the New Testament as it complements the Old. Luke chapter 5, we have a person who is called as one of the disciples. He's one of the 12. In Luke chapter 5, his name is Levi. Verse 27. And after these things, he went forth and saw a publican named Levi, sitting at the receipt of custom. And he said unto him, follow me. And he left all. Watch that. He left all, rose up, and followed him. And Levi made him a great feast in his own house, and there was a great company of publicans and of others that sat down. He left all. Do you remember what was said about Levi in that passage that we looked at some moments ago? That in his faithfulness, Levi said to his brethren, to his mother and father, I don't know you. And we said that in fact, that was a reflection of what they did in loyalty at the golden calf. It was necessary at times to depart even from one's flesh and blood, if necessary. The call of Yahweh was superior to the call and the bonds of men and women. He did not know his mother and father. Not that everybody had to do that. He didn't know his own brethren. And Levi is in the New Testament showing us what the real meaning of Levi was always all about. He was to leave all. Deuteronomy 33 verse 9, which we've looked at and quoted earlier. And you know, when you go to Matthew chapter 10, just hold a marker here. In Matthew chapter 10, look at this. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 36 and 37, in the call of discipleship, Jesus uses the priestly concept of Levi. As Levi himself has just been described as having left all, look at verse 36 of Matthew 10. This is Deuteronomy 33 in verse 9 in application. And a man's foes, verse 36, shall be they of his own household. His own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He said to his father and his mother, I don't know you. He said to his brethren, I don't know you. That's what Levi had to do in extreme situation. And Jesus is saying, do you know what? Disciples at times have to do the same thing because our bond to Christ is above all. Verse 38, and he that taketh not his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. And Levi was willing to leave all and come to the Master. Everything. That's a Levite concept. It's a priestly concept. Not just goods, but family as well, if necessary. So now that's intriguing. Just as we finish here, have you ever seen this? Back in that passage, we deliberately held it off until this moment. In Numbers 18, verse 2 that I had up on the overhead, noticed how we had highlighted joined, 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 joined. He shall be joined in service. He shall be joined in service. Do you know why? Does anyone know what Levi means? Levi means to be joined. That was a play on words in Numbers 18. That was a play on words. And do you know what Levi's other name is? Matthew. In Hebrew, it's Mattathiah, which means gift of Yahweh. They shall be joined unto you as a service of gift. Or as a gift of service. There shall be joined, joined, joined. Numbers 18. And in that context, we highlighted, without explaining all the reasons why, that joined, 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 joined is a play on the Hebrew word Levi. But in that context, it also says, they shall be joined to you, Aaron, as a gift of service. And the Levi of the New Testament has an alternative name called Matthew, which means gift of Yahweh. And he left all, and what he really did was joined himself in discipleship to the Master. He joined himself in discipleship to the Master, fulfilling in front of all the priesthood the real meaning of why Levi was called in the first place and given the special privileges and what the responsibilities were upon him all through his life. Till finally, in the New Testament, it opens up in Luke's Gospel by giving us a snapshot of a true Levite, whose other name was Matthew, and he gives himself as a gift to the service of Christ. May it be, brothers and sisters and young people, that we appreciate in our life of discipleship the importance of all of us being Mattathias, all of us being joined to the Lord as a Levite in training for an eternal priesthood. So there's many principles that overlap, and it's not a matter of looking at one principle above another. Let's close with the words of Brother Roberts. In 1873, Brother Roberts was wrestling with a number of issues. One of them was an atonement issue in 1873. And the problem at that time was trying to balance out the principles as they were working with the problem of clean flesh, an old problem. There is, said Brother Roberts, a place for every element of truth. Are we a flock? Yes. Are we to be a tent? Yes. Are we to live the life related to a temple? Of course. Are we also to be priests? Yes. Are we also supposed to be a bride? Of course. Are we part of a city? Absolutely. Are we part of a flock? Of course we are. There is a place for every element of truth. The difficulty is sometimes to find it. And, says Brother Roberts, the misfortune often finds illustration in one man with one element of truth fighting another man who holds another element, but both equally making havoc of that which properly blended is harmony itself. In looking at the figures of discipleship, therefore, we need to look at all those figures that help us to be balanced disciples. Thank you.